From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Do you worry about the American trade deficit? For some politicians and pundits, it's a big deal, but we'll chat with an expert economist who labels trade deficit fears nonsense. Public charter schools get no taxpayer money now for transportation, but that could change with the proposed grant program. You'll learn why some lawmakers are pushing this option. The North Carolina House has approved a measure that could end up placing more protection for crime victims' rights in the state constitution. You'll learn details about legislation dubbed Marcy's Law. Plus, you'll learn why North Carolina property insurance customers could be hit especially hard by a proposed federal border adjustment tax. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
The United States Supreme Court has decided not to take up North Carolina's election reform law. That was a law that addressed a variety of voting procedures, most notably the requirement of a photo identification to vote. Now, the High Court's decision leaves in place the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling on this law. Here to explain exactly what that is and what it means for you and me is Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal, and of course, Carolina Journal following this story very carefully. Welcome back.
Thank you, Donna.
All right. So what does it mean for the U.S. Supreme Court? They did not actually rule. They just decided that, no, we're not going to hear this.
Right. They decided they were not going to take up an appeal that had been made by the state of the Fourth Circuit's decision. And Chief Justice John Roberts said, we're not going to hear it right now. And we can get into the reasons that were or were not stated in Justice Roberts' very brief order.
That's my question right there.
But basically what this means is that for now the Fourth Circuit's opinion stands, which means that the election law is no longer on the books. And the big provision there was one requiring a photo ID at the polls. But there was also a provision involving same-day voter registration at early voting sites, which was a big thing. And there was also an out-of-precinct voting provision there as well that, again, will now stand because of the Fourth Circuit.
Let's be clear for our listeners then. So as of today, North Carolina cannot require a photo identification to vote.
That's right. That is correct. Can't do that. When the next election rolls around, whether it's municipal or statewide, then people who are not registered to vote can go to an early voting site and can register at the polls. And then also the rule about out-of-precinct voting is still allowed at that point. The people can cast, I guess, what amounts to a provisional ballot that would count for the races that are good in the precinct they vote for, but not for the others.
Let's get into the reasons why, perhaps, some stated, some unstated, as to why the U.S. Supreme Court decided not to look at the case. There's been so many players involved in this, Rick. We have a new Democratic governor. He was playing a role. We've got an attorney general that's been playing a role in the General Assembly, of course. So you put all of these people and these factors into this big pot. Why did the Supreme Court decide to pass?
Well, from what you can infer from what the Chief Justice said, it wasn't exactly clear who the parties were involved in this case other than the plaintiffs who brought the lawsuit. Because at the time the lawsuit was filed, the person who was listed as the defendant was Pat McCrory, who was in the governor of North Carolina. Roy Cooper, who was in the attorney general, had decided not to represent the state in the case, and so the governor had to hire his own counsel. When the governor was defeated for a re-election and Cooper became governor and Josh Stein became the attorney general, they had actually asked to have the case dismissed. And around that time, the General Assembly attempted to get in and say, well, no, 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 we will represent the state of North Carolina because we were the ones who actually crafted the legislation and passed the law. The court decided not to get into this debate about who's representing North Carolina. And that's why an awful lot of legal analysts think that Chief Justice Roberts just basically said, we're not going to decide who represents North Carolina here. We'll pass for now.
Does that mean, Rick, that really their decision to pass has nothing to do with the merits, good or bad, of this law?
That's what Chief Justice Roberts said, actually. He said, I'm not ruling on the merits of this case. And he didn't say, I think it has the possibility of prevailing or not. He said, I'm not going to talk about that at all. So it was more of an issue of if I were to ask the parties to file briefs, who am I going to ask?
It's just too darn confusing.
Yes. And so there are some people. Our reporter Dan Way talked to Greg Wallace at Campbell University Law School, who said that maybe the court would like to have a situation that's not quite as muddied to review, because there are other states that have passed voter ID regulations that are pending in the courts right now, and maybe having a cleaner set of litigants would make it more likely that the court would take up the case. And there are also these other provisions not related to voter ID that muddied the waters a little bit too, I think, for the court.
Is it possible then that the General Assembly would come back and create a brand new law, maybe with the same provisions, maybe with different provisions?
It's quite possible, because we got some signals both from Senate Leader Phil Berger and House Speaker Tim Moore that they were going to review this and that they may well come forward with another law. The challenge now, of course, is that they're going to have to come up with something that would sustain a likely veto from Governor Cooper. So if they try to pass the same bill again, question's going to be, do they have enough votes to sustain that? Or would they make changes? Or would Governor Cooper simply veto anything that requires a photo identification at the polls? And that's right now not very much of an open question, because the governor has signaled that he probably would.
Reaction to the Supreme Court's decision was vociferous from both sides of the aisle. Tell us about that. Let's start first with the governor.
Well, the governor basically said, we've been vindicated. We said all along that this was unconstitutional. We said that it was targeting minority voters, low-income voters, that this was meant to suppress the votes of people who were powerless in society. And so he was very triumphant about it, as were an awful lot of the left-leaning organizations and groups that had supported the lawsuit.
And I believe Dan Way, Carolina Journal's reporter, also had in his story about this that the governor started fundraising.
Yes, that's right. The governor started fundraising on this. And also, I believe Common Cause North Carolina, which is one of the parties involved, has also started fundraising. So immediately they started trying to make some hay of this decision.
What about reaction on the other side? You mentioned Senate Leader Phil Berger. He and other legislative leaders have been dealing with this for years now in the courts.
Right. They make the argument, which I think is fairly compelling, that the Fourth Circuit's opinion was not based so much on the law, but was almost like a lengthy op-ed about what's wrong with laws that are attempting to suppress the vote, in the words of the Fourth Circuit and the supporters of doing away with these voter ID requirements. And so their argument all along was that this was like an argument that you would make for in a doctoral thesis or something like that, or even a class paper, and not a legal opinion based on the law, because as we've discussed earlier, at the trial court level, District Judge Thomas Schroeder issued nearly 500 pages of fact finding, which attempted to forestall the sorts of arguments the Fourth Circuit was going to make, because typically on appeal, the judges don't look at the facts. If the facts are established, they look at the law, and the judges completely ignored that. And so this was a very contentious decision in many, many ways, which makes me think that the General Assembly will come back with something, or possibly someone else might attempt to get some other avenue to get this lawsuit back before the justices again.
Rick, for some reason, election reform law and redistricting, the drawing of the districts, have been the subject of legal challenge for couple of decades here in North Carolina. Why is it we can't seem to do this? I mean, there seems to be questions. You're laughing here. You're smiling over really what the rules are about all these things.
Well, the courts have not been real clear about what the rules are. That's one of the problems that goes along with this, is that the courts have said up until very recently that if one political party wants to gerrymander for partisan reasons to make sure that it maximizes the number of its people who get elected to office, that's okay. But you can't use race as the predominant factor. Now the courts have given a little bit of wiggle room here, and they've sort of said, well, maybe partisan gerrymandering isn't so, you know, such a good thing after all. And so because there really aren't any bright line rules, then the conflict has only grown larger.
So we will wait and see if the General Assembly decides to take up election reform again and put together another bill, or if they're just going to let it be. Because right now in North Carolina, that Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling stands, and that means no photo ID to vote in our state. We've been talking with Rick Henderson. He is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The United States has a trade deficit. Is that bad? Does it matter much at all? Well, joining us to help answer that question is one of the most astute observers of the public policy arena and economics issues, Professor Donald Boudreau of George Mason University. Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be back.
So we do have this trade deficit, and a lot of people say, this is terrible. We need to do something about it. Do we need to do anything about the trade deficit?
No. No. We've had a trade deficit for straight now going on almost 40 years. If you look at most of U.S. history, going back to 1607 when the English settled Jamestown, the vast majority of those years has been trade deficits. A trade deficit is just a fancy name for foreigners investing a lot in your country. And that's not bad. That's good because more capital comes into America. That creates jobs, that expands businesses, that creates new products, that raises wages, that increases the capital value of people's homes and assets. You can tell a story in which trade deficits are a symptom of something bad, but it's kind of a strained story. But in the case of the United States, we run a trade deficit because compared to other countries, we remain an attractive investment destination. Property rights are still reasonably secure. There's still a rule of law. We still largely have a market-oriented economy with a lot of dynamism. We have a large market. All of those factors attract capital here. People want to invest their money here. And so when they sell us things, when foreigners sell us things, rather than cash out all of their dollars immediately buying American exports, they take some of those dollars and they invest them in the United States. The dollars come back to the U.S. They just come back differently than they would come back if they were all for exports. And it's the difference in how they come back that leads to this artifact, this accounting artifact called the trade deficit. But it sounds bad. And Mitch, I've talked about this issue now for 20 years pretty solidly, and I follow it very closely. And I guarantee this is not an exaggeration. I would say that 90% of the news reporters, the editorial writers, the news media, even in some of the better business journals like the Wall Street Journal, 90% don't know what the trade deficit is. They just hear trade deficit. Deficit sounds bad. Therefore, the trade deficit must be bad. They equate it with increasing debt. Sounds like the government budget deficit. It's not the same thing at all. And so because it has a bad sounding name, and people keep repeating over and over again that it spells our doom or it's a symptom of our bad practices, that it must be bad. It's not bad. By and large, I think it's a good, healthy sign, and it also promotes economic health better than that health would be in the absence of the trade deficit.
That is the voice of Donald Boudreau, professor of economics at George Mason University. You mentioned that trade deficit, just the term, sounds bad.
Deficit sounds bad. Yeah.
But aren't there other factors also contributing to why so many people think it actually is bad, sort of the old mercantilist view of the economy?
Yes, it's a mercantilist concept. It dates back to centuries, long before the Industrial Revolution. I like what Adam Smith said about the whole balance of trade doctrine. The trade deficit is part of this whole balance of trade issue. And I quote Adam Smith, quote, "Nothing, however, can be as absurd as this whole doctrine of the balance of trade," end quote. It's a completely absurd doctrine. It's premised on the notion, which is the mercantilist notion, that countries are like businesses. They're just like big businesses. And a country succeeds in trade, the more it exports and the less it imports, with the difference being made up by a receipt of money. As Adam Smith pointed out, people can't eat money. People can't house themselves in money. Money is a medium of exchange. Money is valuable only insofar as ordinary men and women can use that money to buy the goods and services that make their lives better off, that raise their standards of living. And so it's not contrary to the mercantilist notion, contrary to the trade deficit fear. It's not a bad thing when Americans import. It's a good thing. Imports are the benefit we get from trading. Unfortunately, we have to pay for those imports, and exports are the price we pay. This is the complete opposite of the mercantilist myth that sees exports as a benefit. Wow, we're giving stuff away to foreigners. And imports as a cost we have to pay. Wow, and in exchange, we're getting all these consumer electronics and cars and petroleum and clothing. How terrible. We got to minimize that. But you know, this is the notion that the Trump people have, and in it's completely wrong. But in fairness to the Trump people, they are just more open and consistent in their mercantilism, more blatant about their embrace of this myth than most other politicians. There are exceptions, but you show me a politician, I'll scratch that politician and I will find a mercantilist not too far beneath the surface.
Not to get overly wonkish, but some people look at a particular statistic called gross domestic product as one of the greatest things that you should be focusing on in terms of the economy. And if you do focus on GDP, one of its components is exports over imports. So you would think we need to have more exports than imports. Why is that wrong?
Well, it's wrong for a couple of different reasons. And it's hard not to get too terribly wrong, because I'll try to do it. I don't know if I'll succeed. When fashioned in its national income form, income equals consumption plus investment plus government spending minus exports minus imports, the consumption spending is already – the dollars in consumption are already counted in C and I, to the extent that investors spend. And so just to make the accounting work, just honestly, we have to – the international accounts have to subtract those expenditures that are made on imports. If we didn't, we'd count twice, right? So if I buy, I can give a good example now without getting too wonkish. So at one level, it's just an accounting measure that's necessary to avoid double counting. A somewhat different reason that's complementary to that is when foreigners. As I said, when we run a trade deficit, what that means is foreigners are investing in America. And then when foreigners invest in America, that increases the size of our capital stock. We have more factories. We have improved factories. We have more worker R&D. Over time, that increases the productivity of the economy, which raises, if it's measured properly, GDP. There are lots of problems with using GDP as a measure of economic welfare. Putting those – I think it's okay. Putting those aside, over time, the trade deficit should result in higher GDP because it increases the productivity of the economy.
In general, has it been true that when our economy is operating well, operating as well as it can – We're operating with trade deficits and even larger trade deficits as things get better?
Oh, absolutely. All a trade deficit means is that foreigners are especially eager to invest in America. There's nothing wrong with that. Just nothing at all. But to invest in America, foreigners need dollars, and they get dollars by selling us stuff. So we gain. Each American voluntarily chooses or not to buy something from a foreigner. The foreigner voluntarily chooses or not how then to spend or to invest those monies. If all along the way each party gains from these many series of individual bilateral voluntary trades, how can it be that the overall result is negative?
Well, if you have the wrong idea about trade deficits, don't blame Donald Boudreau, professor of economics at George Mason University. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some state lawmakers want to help public charter schools with additional money for bus transportation. It's an idea winning support from Marcus Brandon of Carolina Can.
We have a 20-point gap between those kids that are economically challenged, a.k.a. free and reduced lunch, that attend traditional public schools and those that attend charter schools. So we have known ever since we have started the practice of charter schools that transportation has always been a big issue. And it is our firm belief that you can have the greatest school in the entire world, but if you cannot access them, it means nothing. And so a lot of our economically disadvantaged kids, even though there are a lot of high-quality choices and choices that they would like to make, and especially in terms of charters, they're not able to make them for whatever reasons because of transportation. We also know that the money that is allotted for transportation is not enough to cover for charters, especially when you have a bigger area and bigger ways that you have to cover folks, and you only have 500 to 600 kids versus 40,000 kids in a complete district.
Republican Representative John Hardister is sponsoring the charter grant proposal.
Part of the problem that we've seen over the last few years related to charter schools is that low-income families in some cases can have trouble getting their students to school. And the reasons are obvious. If you have a one-parent household, if you have low-income family, they in some cases may not have a car. They may have a car that's not very reliable. and their situation makes it more difficult for them in many cases to carpool to get students to school. So what we're looking to do here is to provide transportation options for charter schools to make it easier for low-income families to get their students to school. That's why the bill pertains to schools where at least 50% of students are on the free reduced lunch program.
Supporter Alex Quigley offered an example from his days as a charter school principal in Durham County.
I remember very distinctly a dad raised his hand and said, in very broken English, do you provide transportation? And my immediate answer was yes, absolutely, all over Durham County. He ended up enrolling his child, Brian Claros, who came to us in third grade. He wasn't able to read, couldn't read, and didn't speak English. We worked with him over 6 years, and 6 years later, he graduated eighth grade, scoring a 4 in his reading and math EOGs and a 5 on his science EOGs. I actually ran into him at the mall the other day, and he's a sophomore at Riverside High School in all honors classes, doing quite well and on track to graduate for college.
You've been listening to comments supporting a bill targeting public charter schools. It would set up a new grant program to help charters cover some costs of busing their kids to school. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some North Carolina lawmakers are pushing Marcy's Law. It's designed to strengthen the state constitution's protections of crime victims' rights. Wake County Republican Representative Nelson Dollar is helping to lead the campaign.
North Carolina in the past has done an admirable job of working toward empowering victims in our criminal justice system. But as we have looked over our constitutional provisions in North Carolina, as we have consulted with some leading experts in our judiciary, we believe that there are ways to strengthen our constitutional provisions. We want to put this revised constitutional provision on the ballot in an upcoming election and let the people of North Carolina decide.
Why is this so important?
We believe that in North Carolina, we can successfully further strengthen the ability of victims to be able to fully participate in the process and to ensure that the spirit of the rights that are currently in our state constitution are actually operational as they enter, unfortunately, not of their own choice, our criminal justice system.
In the Senate, Wake County Republican Tamara Berenger is pushing a similar measure.
Crime isn't something that only happens in the movies or in the news. It happens here in North Carolina to our citizens, to our friends, to our families, to our neighbors. And those friends, families, and neighbors who suffer at the hands of criminals with this law, once this becomes law, they're going to be informed when the assailants are released, that they're out of jail. They'll also give them a voice and be part of the court proceeding that they've never had before. And so I join with Representative Dollar and all the folks here with us in improving what is a good system of victims' rights, but it will be an even better one once this law passed.
Republican Representative Rena Turner also sees the need for Marcy's Law.
Serving as clerk of Superior Court in Iredell County in my previous life, I had many occasions to work with victims who didn't understand the process, were not sure what their role was, and this is going to help them understand that better, do more of a cooperative effort together, and strengthen those laws that we already have.
You're listening to legislators who support a bill dubbed Marcy's Law. It would ask North Carolina voters to amend the state constitution. Former State Supreme Court Justice Bob Orr explains why.
Why do we need to amend the Constitution if we already have, in Article 1, Section 37, the rights of victims of crime? And the fundamental answer and the important answer is that this proposed constitutional amendment puts into the Constitution specific rights that aren't affected by the language in the current provision, which says as prescribed by law. And without getting too far into the legal weeds, essentially it talks about currently a constitutional right, but then it's left up to the general statutes to define and prescribe how those are to operate. By virtue of this amendment, victims of crime will have a distinct and defined constitutional right specifically articulated in Article 1, our Declaration of Rights. And this will clearly strengthen and give greater clarity to the rights of victims of crime and is an important measure that I hope, one, the General Assembly passes and that the citizens of our state vote to approve.
The process of protecting victims' rights isn't easy.
It is a huge challenge. There are hundreds of thousands of crimes and victims each year that our system has to deal with. And I think we all are committed to making sure that victims' rights are protected, but most importantly, that they're implemented and fulfilled all across this state.
Former Wake County District Attorney Colin Willoughby explained how Marcy's Law would build on existing work to help victims.
Crime victims' rights are important to us as a society. And just like other victims of tragedy, this is a time when we need to protect our most vulnerable. We as a society have a moral obligation to victims of crime. And it's important that we honor that obligation and that we elevate it to that commitment to constitutional protection. District attorneys have been sensitive to crime victims and their rights, and historically that's to whom victims have turned for assistance. And DAs will continue to stand up for victims of crime. That's no different under this law. Most of the rights and protections that are provided in Marcy's Law are in practice currently being provided by judges and clerks and prosecutors and law enforcement across the state. We're ensuring that they can be heard both now and in the future. They'll have a voice in our system, and that'll make our system stronger. The police will continue to do investigations, prosecutors will make better decisions with their cases, and judges will have the needed information to make more informed and better rulings. Marcy's Law is a win for everyone, except maybe the offenders.
What's new in Marcy's Law?
Most of the protections in Marcy's Law are currently in our Victims' Rights Amendment, but they are not have constitutional protection because they're only protected on a statutory basis. But there are some new rights that one is the right to be heard at a time when an offender is being released and at the trial. Previously, that had not been the case for victims. There's the right for the reason to be protected from the accused or a person's acting on behalf of the accused or directed by the accused, free from unreasonable delay to expedite some of these cases. And now, for the first time, if a victim is not given their rights, they can ask the judge to make sure that their rights are afforded to them and they are given the opportunity to be heard and notified of events. And so it's primarily notice and an opportunity to be heard are the things that we're ensuring.
Nelson Dollar, the lead House sponsor, says the campaign has been going on for a while.
That's really been on a quest for a number of years now on a national basis to look at each individual state, their constitutional provisions, and seeing how we can strengthen those. So this effort has been underway successfully in a number of states. North Carolina is now looking at this effort. Again, we feel very strongly on a bipartisan basis, and again, between the two chambers, the Senate and the House, what we've seen in other states and other elections is that when the citizens of our state have the opportunity to truly strengthen and make a difference for victims, the numbers are pretty strong. The public support for victims of crime and wanting to make sure that their rights as victims are truly honored in the judicial system, that resonates with citizens all across the state from, you know, all sorts of groups, you know, urban, rural, and everything in between.
That's Nelson Dollar. He's a Republican state representative from Wake County. He's also the lead sponsor of Marcy's Law. It's designed to strengthen crime victims' rights in the North Carolina Constitution. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal Radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. A proposed federal border adjustment tax would cost North Carolina consumers an additional $800 million in higher property casualty insurance premiums over the next decade. That is the bottom line conclusion from a new report issued by the John Locke Foundation and the Washington, D.C.-based R Street Institute. Dr. Lawrence Powell is one of the authors of this report. He is the director of the Alabama Center for Insurance Information and Research at the University of Alabama. Dr. Powell, welcome to Carolina Journal Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Let's talk first about exactly what a border adjustment tax is. How would that work?
Sure. Well, that's a really good question. The details of the legislation have not been released yet, so it leaves us to make a few assumptions. No matter which way you make the assumptions, they're all bad, but it's a matter of how bad it might be. We make some pretty conservative or some very conservative assumptions in our study. But so the way it works is whenever you buy something from outside of the United States, there would be a tax that you would have to pay for it, which in essence would mean that the expenses you have that come from outside of the country would not be tax deductible. That's the way it would manifest on any sort of company's income statement.
And this is actually a proposal from the U.S. Congress, not yet implemented, but is being discussed.
Right, exactly. That's the idea of a border-adjusted tax or a destination-based cash flow tax. There's a lot of names for them, and none of them are easy to say, but that's essentially what it does is takes away the tax deductibility of various expenses as an inducement to have people or to have companies move their operations to the U.S.
And it's commonly known as BAT, B-A-T. Our listeners may have heard it referred to that way if they follow news analysis and coverage. So, Dr. Powell, the question then is, this proposal, if implemented, would have an impact on North Carolina, and that's detailed in the report that has been released by the Locke Foundation and the R Street Institute. Now, you're an author. Explain to us, then, the way in which North Carolina would be impacted.
Okay, so a little bit of background. when we try to apply this, and I do not have a preference between a border adjusted tax or any other sort of tax in terms of the overall economy. That's not my area of expertise or specialization. But when it comes to financial services, almost every country that has any sort of similar tax exempts financial services, including insurance and reinsurance and banking, from this, because you don't bring any jobs onshore from taxing financial services this way, because it's more the movement of capital as opposed to the movement of labor. So that's an important distinction. And the reason why that would affect North Carolina, North Carolina has a large exposure to hurricanes, obviously, several hundred miles of coastline where you can have those losses. And the losses can be so big that it's hard to, if you think about the way insurance works, you want to have a lot of things that could possibly happen that are not positively correlated. I mean, having one of them happen does not make it more likely that another one happens. So a good example is life insurance. When one person dies, it doesn't mean another person is more likely to die. It's an independent event. And so you can take the average outcome of that, and it becomes very predictable. For a hurricane, when your average hurricane is 207 miles wide, and the density of the population along the coast of the U.S., including North Carolina, if you have a loss, it's going to affect almost everyone at the same time. And so you've got to have enough money to pay everyone's full loss at the same time. That means the companies have to hold a lot of additional money, capital, money above what they expect to pay out. Well, one way you can reduce that amount is by insuring hurricanes in North Carolina, earthquakes in California, but also earthquakes in New Zealand and Japan and floods in Europe and the tsunamis in different places. You've got all these other earthquakes in Canada. You've got all these other exposures that you can pool your risk with. And where that happens is in a global reinsurance market.
And so reinsurance is really the crux of this.
Yes, yes, it exactly is. So reinsurance is essentially insurance for insurance companies. It lets them get more diversification in their liabilities and their expected losses, so they don't have to hold as much capital to remain as safe as they currently are.
So, Dr. Powell, then, this reinsurance, how is it then that this border adjustment tax proposal, is it that it would make this reinsurance much more expensive? Is that why it would cost North Carolinians more to have property and casualty insurance?
Well, right now, more than half of the catastrophe reinsurance market is not in the United States. And all of a sudden, those expenses would no longer be tax deductible. So you would essentially add 20% to the cost of any reinsurance that's ceded to London or Germany or Bermuda or Asia or anywhere else that's not in the U.S., which is where most of this is reinsured to. And you bring all that onshore to the U.S., and now you no longer have a mechanism where you can share those risks of Japanese earthquake, New Zealand earthquake, Australian storms, UK floods, all of that everyone becomes isolated in their risk. And so now we've already got an issue where the U.S. has more catastrophe exposure than the rest of the world put together by a large margin. So the benefit we do get from pooling with these other countries around the globe completely goes away. And what we show in the paper, what we show in our analysis is that because it's not because the reinsurance becomes more expensive, that it's not a direct line to that. It's that reinsurance can no longer be global because it becomes cost prohibitive. And so then it moves all into the U.S. where we can't then share our risk with other countries and they can't share theirs with us. And those are very good things when they can happen. It keeps the price of insurance low.
So when there is a higher risk than folks in North Carolina who are trying to get property insurance are going to be facing higher premiums.
Exactly. That's the long and short of it, is that we would see that that's what we're estimating, is because we would have to raise additional capital in the U.S., when we apportion a percentage of that to North Carolina, it comes out to be about $800 million over the next decade.
Well, Dr. Powell, why then would this even be considered, considering this impact on North Carolina and presumably other states for other reasons?
Wow, I wish you hadn't asked that. that's a very political question, and I try not to be a political person, but I'll tell you what I've heard, as long as I don't have to claim it, is that the optics of that would be really bad. If you're passing a tax that's going to be, it's highly opposed by all of the retail companies, your Walmart, Apple, everybody that sells things to consumers thinks that in the U.S. that might manufacture them outside of the country, thinks that this would be bad for them, and so they don't like it. I'm not speaking from this, is what I've heard. And then you say, oh, but we're going to exempt multi-billion-dollar reinsurance and insurance companies and banks, and just throw in hedge funds to make it look even worse. The political optics of it, I think, wouldn't play well. And so the initial pushback when people have suggested, why don't we exempt financial services just like all the other countries do, that have a tax like this, you say, it's a political problem. It's not an economic problem.
Dr. Lawrence Powell is the director of the Alabama Center for Insurance Information and Research at the University of Alabama. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.